Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Save big on home updates at Menards. Transform your floors and walls with stylish Mohawk porcelain tile. 12 by 24 inch urban forge tiles combine a bold modern look with the timeless beauty of natural stone for a stunning result. Plus, they feature StepSure, an advanced slip-resistant technology providing safety without compromising style. Save big money on Mohawk porcelain tile. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where if you remember last time, I left the narrative with the death of Edward III, who was an old king. He reigned for quite a long time. Well, he wasn't that old in our terms. He was in his 60s. But his first son, the Prince of Wales, the Black Prince, had himself died in his 40s. Of some disease we're not entirely sure, probably dysentery finally carried him off, but he'd been ill for a long time with something. And so the crown passes down to his son, a Richard, known to history as Richard II. But he was a small child. He was about 10 years old. And so he ruled in his minority, so they say. And so that's always worrisome in the pre-modern period when you've got a child monarch, because what it really means is there's going to be a power struggle over who controls him. If it's not entirely clear who will control him, then there'll be some sort of power struggle. And even if there isn't a power struggle, if the regent or the person or persons that control him aren't good, then it's just the same as having a bad king. So where we went from a very strong monarch in Edward I to a terrible monarch in Edward II, back to a good one in Edward III, now we're back to a bad one with Richard II. So it's a reign of instability and failures as far as the English crown is concerned. So I'll pick up the story again with Professor Sir Charles Oman and maybe quote a bit from Churchill as well in his History of the English Speaking Peoples. So I'll let Oman continue. He says this, quote, "The little king Richard II was a boy 10 years old, born in the year when his father went on his ill-fated expedition to Spain to help Don Pedro." That was when his father, the Black Prince, was ruling in Aquitaine and had gone to help out in Navarre in Spain. And that's where he'd first got his illness. So the Black Prince had been ill on and off for something like 10 years before he finally died. Richard's mother was Joan, Countess of Kent, the heiress of that unfortunate Earl Edmund, whom Mortimer beheaded in 1330. She had been a widow when the Black Prince wedded her and had two sons by her first husband, Sir Thomas Holland. These two half-brothers of King Richard were 10 years his seniors and were destined to be not unimportant figures in the history of his reign. Their names were Thomas Holland, Earl of Kent, and John Holland, Earl of Huntingdon. So on top of Edward III having many, many sons and therefore many, many grandsons, on top of that are Joan's children. So not only have we got a small boy ruling in his minority, but we've got lots of different factions, lots of different power groups, lots of different people vying for positions of influence. It doesn't bode well. There's too many people who want power for themselves. As Abraham Lincoln once eloquently put it, there's too many pigs for the tits. Oman continues, "The helplessness of the young king, the son of the deeply mourned Black Prince, at first touched the hearts of all men. And the parties which were represented by John of Gaunt, who is the third son of Edward III, and he and his progeny become extremely important in the next generations. So John of Gaunt, a name to remember, the younger brother of the Black Prince. So very, very close to the throne. The parties which were represented by John of Gaunt and William of Wickham reconciled themselves and agreed to join in serving the king faithfully. A council of regency was appointed in which both were represented. And it was agreed that Parliament alone should choose and dismiss the king's ministers." So on top of lots and lots of family machinations, throw on top of that Parliament as just another faction, another power faction. "This happy concord, however, was not to last for long. The conduct of the foreign affairs of the nation was left in John of Lancaster's hands." That's John of Gaunt, so the king's uncle. "And the continued misfortunes in the French war were laid to his charge. The troops of Charles V were still," that the King of France, "were still carrying everything before them. They conquered all Aquitaine save Bordeaux and Bayonne and overran the Duchy of Brittany, the sole ally of England on the continent. Moreover, fleets of Norman privateers had begun to appear in the Channel. They landed boldly on the English coast and burnt Winchelsea, Portsmouth and Gravesend. So we largely think of the Hundred Years' War as English armies in France laying waste to things, chevaucheting across the French countryside, which is largely true, almost entirely true, but not 100% of the cases we've just told there. There were times here and there when the French did it to us, and we certainly didn't control the Channel for large portions of it. Again, we think of England sort of always controlling the Channel, but, you know, it's not the case. Omar again, quote, "To restore the fortune of war, money was urgently needed, and Duke John kept asking for more and more, to the discontent both of the Parliament and the nation. He was granted in 1379 a poll tax, wherein every man was assessed according to his estate. From dukes and archbishops, who paid £6.13.4, to agricultural labourers, who paid fourpence. In 1830, followed another tax, graduated from £1 to £1 on every grown man or woman." So a tax on just being alive, a poll tax, basically. "It was the collection of this very unpopular tax that precipitated the violent outbreak of a discontent that had been smouldering among the lower classes for the last 30 years. Ever since the Black Death," which, if you remember, hit England between 1348 and 49, so, you know, 30 years ago now. "Ever since the Black Death, a silent but bitter contention had been in progress between the landholding classes and their tenants, more especially those who were still villeins and bound to the soil." A villain, you know, if you're bound to the soil legally, it's you're an indentured slave, essentially, a serf. It's another way to put it. "The main stress of the struggle had come from the fact that the dearth of labourers, the low number of labourers, and the rise in wages, which resulted from the Black Death, had caused the lords of the manors to press more hardly on their tenants, i.e. there are less people to do the work, so the remaining people just simply have to work harder." Well, you can't squeeze that lemon too hard. You can't squeeze that until the pips go squeak, because something's going to erupt. "They," the landholding class, "they tried to get all the labour they could out of the villeins and refused to take money payments for their farms instead of days of labour on the Lord's fields. It seems, too, that they strove to claim as villeins many who were or wished to be free rent-paying, copyhold or leasehold tenants." So if anything, the powers that be, the lords of the manors, tried to just condemn even more people into their serfdom. "Moreover, when forced to hire free labour, they tried to underpay it, relying on the scale of wages fixed by the Statute of Labourers in 1351, instead of abiding by the laws of supply and demand." So mentioned there is that quite important Statute of Labourers. So that, if you remember last time, Edward III had brought that in to try and stabilise the situation. 1351, so straight after, or really still during the Black Death, to prevent all of society or the entire labour market from sort of completely collapsing, or the few remaining people just demanding extortionate or truly unpayable wages. It had been written into law, written into statute, and that they couldn't demand silly wages. So it's both good and bad. Some historians say that was terrible, like an evil thing to do. And others argue that it actually might have saved the country from the fabric of society from completely imploding and ending up in just abject anarchy. It's probably a bit of both, right? It may well be a bit of both. Some people speak of that 1351 Statute of Labourers as pure evil, and others argue it's entirely necessary. Anyway, 30 years down the line, or the best part of 30 years later, it's not really holding water. It's not really okay. It's become clear that at least a generation later now, that it's out of date. It may have been needed to hold the fabric of society together 30 years ago, but now it's just holding people down, right? A generation later, the argument that it was a good thing isn't a very strong argument anymore. It's simply keeping people as indentured slaves or serfs or villeins, however you want to phrase it. Again, not allowing just free economy or the laws of supply and demand, as Omar puts it, simply not allowing that to play out a generation later is not cool, should we say. Omar goes on. "The pressure on the part of the lords led to combinations in secret clubs and societies among the tenants, who agreed to refuse the statutory wages and determined to agitate for the removal of all the old labour rents. Their idea was to commute all such service to on their little holdings into money rents at the rate of 4 pence for every acre, i.e. when the moneyed landed classes realised that the people sort of reasonably can demand higher wages. They work together in some sort of cabal, where possible, to keep the people down. But the rising of 1380, this is the Peasants' Revolt, the famous Peasants' Revolt, but the rising of 1380 was due to many other causes beside the grievance of the Villeins. Much discontent can be traced to the mismanagement of the French War, which was all laid on John of Gaunt's shoulders. There was this idea in the medieval mind, the pre-modern mind, that if you were successful in war, it was because God wanted it. And, of course, if you were unsuccessful in war, it was because God wanted it, or the heavens wanted it that way. So if you keep losing, then God doesn't like you, or your cause doesn't favour your cause. So it can be extremely damaging politically, not just if you keep losing militarily. John of Gaunt certainly suffers from that. In the towns, which were no less violently disrupted than the countryside, there was an old grudge between the governing oligarchs of wealthy citizens and the poorer classes, who felt themselves excluded from any share of power. I mean, that's just a statement of fact, really. In the late 14th century still, there was no concept of democracy, none at all. Obviously, there'd been ancient democracies of a type, you know, ancient Athens, for example. But in 14th century northwestern Europe, in England, there was no such thing. Again, the average person was something like an indentured slave. In London, at least, the journeymen and apprentices were ready to rise against the employers of labour. There was also a grudge against alien merchants and manufacturers, especially the Flemings, recently introduced to foster the woollen trade in the eastern counties. So a big part of England's economy at this stage was trading wool with what becomes Holland and Belgium from the eastern counties, so like Norfolk, Suffolk, Kent, Essex, those places. A massive part of the whole economy of the country was that. And if there were Flemings coming over and stealing business in England, that didn't go down well. A certain amount of organisation was given to the movement by the teaching of itinerant agitators, mostly friars, who had been preaching communism and the equality of all men. If you remember before, I'd mentioned Wycliffe, a very, very early precursor to Protestantism, or Luther, saying the sorts of things Luther would say in a century and a half's time. You know, aren't all men equal under the eyes of God? Aren't we all? Jesus in the Gospels doesn't say anything about how it's right or legal for some people to essentially own other people. Is that godly? John Ball, the best known of these fanatical preachers, was wont to perambulate the country delivering sermons on his favourite text. And this is a quote, I believe it's from Langland's Piers Plowman. When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then a gentleman, i.e., you know, there were no lords and ladies and serfs and villeins and tenants in chief and rent payers when there was only Adam and Eve, right? God didn't create a world like that. So why are we doing it that way now, basically? It's just not fair is what it boils down to. It's just not fair. And we've had enough. You, the landed gentry, the moneyed class, you need us, the labourers, the normal people, you need us more than we need you right now, right? 30 years after the Black Death, living in a sort of almost a post-apocalyptic world in a way, something like a half, maybe as much as two-thirds in places of all people that have died. And, you know, one generation later, you're still living absolutely in the aftermath of that. You're living in sort of a ruined, devastated landscape in all sorts of ways. Yeah, almost post-apocalyptic. So you guys need us much more than we need you, Omar again. Wherever men were oppressed and discontented, they listened eagerly to these discourses and began to talk of putting an end to all difference between man and man and dividing all things equally between them. But it was only the wider spirits who were imbued with these doctrines. The majority, like most discontented Englishmen in all ages, were only set on the practical task of endeavouring to redress their own particular grievances and to better their condition. I.e., you know, people are essentially selfish, or rather consumed by their own problems and their own life, and it's difficult to get them to see the bigger picture and act as a collective. That's always a difficult thing, even in the 14th century. It was in June 1381 that the rising broke out so dangerously in almost the whole of eastern England, from Yorkshire to Hants. It has gained its name of Wat Tyler's Rebellion from Walter the Tyler of Maidstone, who was chief of the insurgents in Kent. Curiously enough, four other men bearing or assuming the names of the Tyler, were prominent in the Troubles. The main incidents of the Rising took place around London, towards which the insurgents flocked from all quarters. Simultaneously, the men of Essex, under a chief who called himself Jack Straw, marched to Hampstead, those of Hertfordshire to Highbury, and those of Kent to Blackheath. On their way, they had done much damage. Everywhere they pillaged the houses of the gentry, and sought out and burnt the manor rolls, which preserved the records of the duties and obligations of the villeins to the lord of the manor. From Essex, the rebellion spread into Norfolk and Suffolk, where Cavendish, the Chief Justice of England, and several other notables were murdered. So a few things there. There's a place in Essex called Brentwood, very close to where I was born and raised. It seems to be one of the places where rebellion first sprung up. But there's a very important thing to mention there. Omar tells us about that the manor rolls were burnt, and that the record of the duties and obligations were burnt with those honour rolls. Well, he's talking about debt, money, who and who wasn't a serf. So massively important. If you burn those manor rolls, it's like wiping out credit or something. Or more than that, it's bigger than that. If you destroy all the records of who owes who what in various different ways, then that can be the whole ballgame. It's extremely important and also disappointing from the point of view of a historian, just because a lot of records are gone. They go up in smoke. But still, it may have been for the greater good. Who knows? But also, Oman is very low-key on this, but lots of people were murdered, humiliated, tortured, murdered, all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's a rebellion, a full medieval rebellion. So scores got settled, put it that way. The story goes on. The King's Council at London was quite helpless, for the sudden rising had taken them by surprise, and they had no troops ready. Seeing the city surrounded by the rioters, they shut its gates and sent to ask what were the grievances and demands of the mob. The claims that were formulated by the leaders of the rising were more moderate than might have been expected, for the wilder spirits were still kept in order by the cooler ones. They asked that villeinage should be abolished, and all lands held on villein tenure be made into leasehold farms, rated at 4 pence an acre, that the tolls and market dues, which heightened the price of provisions, should be abolished, and that all who had been engaged in the rising should receive a full pardon for the murders and pillage that had taken place. So some reasonable demands there, it seems, in retrospect. Others perhaps not. But a time of real political turmoil. You know, it's a bit more than a riot, isn't it? It is really the fabric of society becoming unravelled here. The rule of law itself coming under attack, whether righteously or not. But, you know, it's an extremely perilous situation, at least as far as the crown is concerned, and or the baronage, the moneyed class, landlords. A class struggle. It's a class struggle, the peasants' revolt, certainly. To continue, these demands were not too violent to be taken into consideration. While the councillors hesitated, the young king, who displayed a spirit and resource most unusual in a boy of 14, announced that he would himself go to meet the rioters and try to quiet them, for as yet they had not said or done anything implying disrespect for the royal name. So Wat Tyler and John Ball and the like want a fairer deal, but they're not calling for the king's head or anything like that. But yeah, Richard II, at the age of 14, volunteers, is prepared to personally ride out and meet them, man to man, face to face. It's really quite brave for a 14-year-old, I'd say. You know, a murderous mob that are riding roughshod over the rule of law. He's just going to go out and personally parley with them. Okay. But meanwhile, traitors inside the city betrayed London Bridge to the rebels. Tyler and the Kentish men crossed the Thames, and the whole mob of the capital rose to join them. So London itself also now largely in revolt. Their united forces started operations by burning John of Gaunt's great palace of the Savoy in the Strand, and along with it the temple, the chief abode of the men of law. They slew many foreign merchants and some lawyers, and the two classes whom they seem most to have hated, but wrought no general pillage or massacre. So it's bloody, very, very bloody, but it's not complete anarchy. It's difficult to really get a feel for this moment in the Peasants' Revolt, how bad it was. I think if you were actually there, it would have seemed like there was no law and order. I mean, there's no police force, for example, none. That's not until, what, the 19th century, so there's certainly no police force or anything even close. The Crown would have needed troops, and they haven't got any at this moment in London. or they've got very few, rather, should I say. There are some knights around, as we shall see. Oman goes on. On the 14th of June, Richard, the king, 14-year-old king, Richard, persisting in his resolve of bringing the insurgents to reason, rode out of the Old Gate and met the multitude at Mile End, that's in East London. After hearing their petitions, he declared that they contained nothing impossible and that he would undertake that they should be granted. So it looks like he's going to give the peasants what they want. But while the king was parleying with them, Tyler and a band of extremists burst into the Tower, that's the Tower of London, where the council had been sitting, and committed a hideous outrage. They caught Simon of Sudbury, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was massively hated, by the way, and blamed for loads of the things that were going wrong within the state, who was also Chancellor, Sir Robert Hales, the High Treasurer, the Legate, who had formed the obnoxious poll tax, dragged them forth to Tower Hill, and there slew them, end quote. So, once again, let's not underestimate that. These are the most important men of the realm, easily. The Archbishop of Canterbury and the High Lord Treasurer, they're the people directly below the king. And, of course, the king being a boy, these men control policy. And so the peasants have just broken into the inner sanctum of power, dragged these people out by their hair, by the scruff of their neck, or whatever, and murdered them. Simon Sudbury apparently had his throat cut on Cheapside by a bread knife. Right, it is like bursting in on the Prime Minister or the President or something and murdering them. It's as serious as it gets. Notwithstanding these murders, the young king persisted in his design of treating with the insurgents. He felt like he had little other choice, right? If they can do that with impunity, hasn't got a very strong hand, has he? He bade Tyler and his host meet him next day in Smithfield outside the city gates. They came, but Tyler, who had throughout shown himself the most violent of the insurgents, began wrangling with the king's suite, the king's men, and unsheathed his weapon before Richard's face. This so enraged William Walworth, the mayor of London, that he drew a short sword and hewed the rebel down from his horse. I stabbed him. You know, how dare you draw your sword in front of the king? Like you're going to threaten him, like you're going to kill him. Well, I'm not having that. So he just killed what Tyler right there on the spot, it seems. In front of everyone as well. In front of all the peasants who were running amok through London. He might have thought that might be a suicidal thing to do. But anyway, that's apparently how it went down. Apparently that's what happened. Then one of the king's squires leapt down and stabbed him as he lay, finishing him off, making sure, again, in front of everyone, that Wat Tyler was dead. Walworth's act was likely to have cost the king and his whole party their lives, for the insurgents bent their bows and shouted that they would avenge their captain there and then. But Richard, again, only 14, with extraordinary presence of mind in one so young, pushed his horse forward and bade them stand still, for they should have their demands granted, and he himself would be their captain, since Tyler was dead. So there in Smithfield, he had a charter drawn up, conceding all that the insurgents asked, and pardoning them for their treason. Satisfied with this, the Kentish men dispersed to their homes.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, America. It's your new favourite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two-fourths of the British podcast No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.